Hi, my name is Richard Hill. I'm the Public Affairs Director here at WPKN. And as part of our mission to bring more attention to some of the 42, count them, 42 talk, public affairs, and interview shows that are on our roster, I'm doing a series of interviews with some of the programmers. And what we're trying to do is just to get people more aware of this incredibly diverse roster of shows. And the issue with that is that many of them are, like, for example, one that we'll talk about tonight, because our guest is Melinda Tuhus, whose show is a half-hour show called The Forest and the Trees. And that runs on the second Saturday of each month from 9:30 to 10. So if you were just a random person looking for environmental programming, you would have a hell of a time trying to find that show and actually try to target it for your listening. And so I think the more we can sort of highlight these programs, the better, because they're so excellent. They don't happen anywhere else on Connecticut's airwaves. And it's really remarkable that this little station can create that much content. And so I want to introduce Melinda Tuhus, who has been a programmer here at WPKN lo these many years. I'm going to say probably at least a decade, Melinda. Am I right?
Way more.
Yeah. So how many years have you been a programmer here at WPKN?
Well, I've been contributing one segment a week to Between the Lines, which is a half-hour weekly show that runs a couple of times on air, for between 25 and 30 years. And my show that you mentioned, The Forest and the Trees, has been going on for over 20 years with, I
Oh.
took a 2-year hiatus after about 15 years, and then I came back. So it's been close to 20.
Yeah, and you just mentioned Between the Lines, and that, of course, is a show that's produced by Scott Harris, one of our fabulous public affairs programmers. And that show has been going on since, I think, the early ni 1991. I think it was during the
Yeah.
first Gulf War that that show started. But we'll get to that one because I think we'll do one interview with Scott Harris soon. So, Melinda, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you took it upon yourself to be an independent journalist and also a radio programmer.
So I've had some jobs, some staff jobs, and then I've done a lot of freelancing. I like to freelance because I get to decide what stories I want to work on, assuming somebody wants me to do them and pay me for it. And that's something I really like about, doing it that way. And also when I travel, I have gotten to go to a lot of places in the US and other places around the world and do radio stories as well as, print stories about various things. So it's been something that I've been doing since the early 90s, I guess. There was a stint there for quite a few years where I was reporting for a national radio show called Free Speech Radio News that WPKN used to carry. It was a half hour Monday through Friday show, and I did innumerable features for them from all over the place, which I really loved doing because I didn't have to necessarily be quote unquote objective and hide my politics behind some sort of fabricated idea of, being neutral, not having an opinion of what I was reporting on, because the things I wanted to report on were the things I cared about and I did have an opinion about, which isn't to say, that I didn't include other points of view in the stories. Of course, I did that. But it when you report for more mainstream outlets, it's just a lot stricter. Like, you're really not supposed to do anything outside of your reporting and just be a reporter and not have a life. That's how it felt to me. So I really have enjoyed doing it this way.
Well, before we get to address some of that incredible array of journalism that you did for Free Speech Radio News and for other outlets right here in Connecticut, Why don't you tell us a little bit more about The Forest and the Trees and what's the gist of that show? And to what extent do you literally brainstorm about all the different topics that could fit under that rubric?
So the full title is The Forest and the Trees, Global and Local Perspectives on the Environment. And so that allowed me to do a lot of international reporting. But more recently, I have tended to focus more on local and statewide issues, because I think, you know, listeners could get international news from a lot of sources. And the idea of, you know, looking more deeply into some local and statewide issues with guests who are expert in various fields is something that I think is a real, it's a service, it's a community service. And then I learn a lot too. And I also have said that, you know, just about all the stories I do have an environmental or a climate focus. I think the only time I have veered from that, and you could actually still say it's environmental, is I've reported on events in Israel and Palestine a few different times. The most recent was after the latest war broke out. I did a show about that, but I have done a few others. But there's a real environmental component to wars. So it does fit still, but it's a little bit of a different way of looking at it.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think we're hearing more and more about the fact, well, as you say, war is hell on the environment. War is hell anyway, but you know, just the way that it contributes to climate change is being now, probably for the first time in human history, it's being measured and calibrated and decried by people that are concerned about the environment. So it's interesting. I'm remembering a program that you did on The Forest and the Trees, specifically on Sleeping Giant Park. And it was after the tornadoes that swept through that park and did such massive destruction to sections of it, not to the whole park, but to the entry area where those fabulous 120-foot white pines stood all over the place. It's now basically bare. You know, it's like there are no trees there in the entry section of the park. But I remember you, I don't know if you even remember this show, but you were walking around with a crew that had chainsaws and God knows what other equipment. And you were like over the hum and grinding sound of those chainsaws, sometimes interviewing the guys and women who were doing that job. And it was fascinating to me. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I joined the trail crew after, I hadn't been on it previously, but I joined lots of other people with me, joined the trail crew after the tornado, because at first there's 32 miles of trails plus the main trail that, you know, that goes up to the tower. Mm-hmm. And the state had said that nobody could go in there and they were going to clean it all up. And then they soon realized they would never get it done. And so they told the Sleeping Giant Park Association, which is the group that, you know, had the trail crew, that yes, they could go in and they could remove, you know, the trees from the trails and so on. But everybody who was going to operate a chainsaw had to do training, which was actually a really good idea. Up to then, they hadn't necessarily been certified, but now everybody using a chainsaw was certified. Yeah, it was interesting. I completely lucked out into a crew where the sawyer had an electric saw. And wow. I'm telling you, it was a world of difference. It was much quieter than the gas powered saws and much cleaner and much, you know, those other ones are so stinky. So it made a noise, but it wasn't like an overpowering noise. So I don't remember the details, but I know when I did it, because it was in 2018 that, you know, the tornado happened. Yeah, it was a good piece for radio, because, you know, you could hear all the noise.
That's right. And you were chatting with the people that were working with you. And I think I did become aware in that interview that you were on the crew, that it was this very, you know, just take it as it comes kind of interview, talking to people while they were working, asking questions. What do you think about cutting this place? You know, it was very kind of like immediate journalism. Very cool.
Well, you know.
give a
Can
shout out.
Can I tell you who the very first guest was that I had when I started the show back around a little after 2000?
Please do.
It was Wangari Maathai, who was a woman in Kenya who started the Greenbelt movement, which was planting trees. Like it started in Kenya and it spread to many other countries, and they planted like millions of trees. She was doing a semester at Yale, I think at the forestry school, which is now called the School of the Environment. And yeah, I got to interview her. I was very excited. And I loved that interview. That was my first show.
So that's up on SoundCloud.
You know, the sad thing is, I don't even know if anybody knew about SoundCloud 20 years ago.
That's true.
I have to see if my 2018 show about the park is even on SoundCloud. I've been doing it now for a number of years, but it may not go back that far. So that might not be saved either. I'd actually love to go back and listen to it, but I'm not sure I can find it. It may not exist anywhere.
Yeah, well, of course, you're quite right that back in 2000, I don't think PKN had a SoundCloud page, and much of the recording back then, you can correct me on this, but you may have been recording with an actual tape recorder as opposed to a digital recorder.
Yeah, and I think most of the things I've been working on since then, because I know when I worked with Free Speech Radio News, it was all digital. So I think that was digital then too. But well, I think the Wangari Maathai one actually was on a cassette, now that you mention it, you know, like a cassette recorder.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, you know.
Yeah, not the best sound quality either, I have to say.
But, you know, charming in its own way, right?
Right.
So it's great to remember that interview, the Sleeping Giant interview, that was so great. And but you've done so many others. So why don't you maybe talk about some of your favorites, some of the most maybe impactful ones. And you talked about focusing on environmental issues in Connecticut. Maybe you could also talk about what some of the challenges are in Connecticut regarding the environment.
I guess I could. The ones that are more memorable to me are the ones that I did outside of Connecticut, you know, like when I was in the West Bank and Palestine, and when I was down after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and when I've been down to observe the hideous practice of mountaintop removal coal mining in West Virginia. So those are the ones that more come to mind. But in terms of, well, like my upcoming show, which will be on the second Saturday of March, is with a woman who actually wrote in to me and a couple other people that she felt like when we talk about the climate, we always talk about fossil fuels. And she said there's another crisis, which is the biodiversity crisis. And I totally agreed with her that it is a crisis and they're interrelated. And I agreed that we don't give it nearly enough attention. So that's going to be my next show. And we were talking about Connecticut specifically. But, you know, there's just, you know, there's innumerable options for doing interviews with people working on environmental issues and climate issues in Connecticut. And I'm actually thinking of trying to get a second half hour show so I could be on twice a month instead of once a month. And I think that would help people find me. Some people say you have to be on every week or people won't.
I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm ready for that, or even if there's a slot for me, if I wanted to do it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty daunting. It was bringing back to mind Scott Harris, who does Counterpoint every week and has been doing so. I mean, I think the first time I heard Scott Harris do Counterpoint, it was like, Christ, it must have been in the 80s or something. You know,
it's at least 30 years. Yeah.
In fact, that was the first time I actually tuned into WPKN. I don't know. Somebody mentioned it and I tuned in the station and boom, there's Scott Harris. This, you know, absolutely powerful public affairs show with interviews that you do not hear anywhere else. I mean, even Democracy Now!, which has to produce a show every day, every weekday, they cannot go into the kind of depth, nor can they get the range of, you know, topics that Scott can cover on his show, which is once a week. But still, I just can't believe he can do that every week. Four guests, right? Every show. But your format is to have a guest or two, right?
Right.
So your next show, it is actually this coming Saturday. It's this coming Saturday at 9:30 in the morning.
Right.
And yeah, so remind us again about the topic and the guest.
The guest is Denise Savageau, who has been around in environmental circles in Connecticut for decades. And it's focusing on the kind of interrelationship between the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis. And, you know, just talking about how that can, that's an important area that has not been really focused on as much as it should be.
Talk a little bit about the biodiversity crisis. I'm not sure everybody knows what that means.
Well, the biodiversity crisis is that we're losing plants and animals at a rate many times greater than what they call the background rate of extinction. And, you know, it's pretty much all tied to human behavior, either removing their habitats by developing areas that, you know, they've lived in, or through the warming of the planet, forcing animals to try to move to where, you know, they can still survive, or if they're plants and they can't really move or they don't move fast enough, they will go extinct. And it's a huge and tragic situation. We need to talk about more.
Bring it down to Connecticut. And what are we struggling with here in that regard?
Well, here's one. And this was, I had done a feature about this for another radio show, a national radio show several years ago, that lobsters are disappearing from Long Island Sound. And there were different theories about why that might be so. There was a lot of thought given to, you know, pesticide contamination, you know, from runoff, from putting pesticides and other things on your lawns, et cetera. But the consensus, the scientific consensus eventually was that it's the water is warming. The water in Long Island Sound is warming really fast because it's, you know, it's a pretty small body of water, and that the lobsters are cold weather creatures. So they were literally migrating up to Maine. I mean, there's already a lot of lobsters in Maine, but they were joining their brethren up in like the Gulf of Maine because it was too hot here.
Yeah, I wonder what those Maine lobsters think when all these southern New England lobsters come strolling up into their
right.
territory. Well, you know, the similar issue on the Cape, on Cape Cod, and in the past, well, I don't know, 10 years or so, maybe 15, possibly, get more and more reports of shark attacks on human beings on the Outer Cape. This goes from Orleans going out to the tip in Provincetown. People know the Cape. They know what I'm talking about. And a lot of that has to do, apparently, with the increased seal population. The bottom line there is that there's more and more seals that are aggregating, you know, between Orleans and Provincetown on the ocean side. And the sharks feed on the seals. And so there's just much more shark activity in shallow waters where the seals swim. I mean, you could stand on the beach, like on an ocean beach, like let's say Head of the Meadows Beach, Truro, and literally there's a seal will swim by with its snout in the air, like 10 feet out from the actual shoreline.
I mean,
if the sharks are chasing those seals, you know, you can see why it would create a big issue for the human. And on the Outer Cape now, they have these emergency tourniquet setups so that right at the beginning of each beach, so that if there is a shark attack, there might be some hope of saving somebody's limb. I'm really fascinated by some of those interviews you did, you know, in West Virginia, mountaintop removal. And maybe you could say a word about that one and how you navigated that. You know, you must have been stepping on some toes out there. I'm not sure if you encountered the perpetrators, I should say, of the mountaintop removal, or whether you were just dealing with the people who were feeling its effects.
Yeah, well, there was one time, one of the more recent times. I went there several times between about 2010 and, I don't know, 2014, 2015. And I was, you know, mostly dealing with people who were opposed to the practice. But there was one time where there was a big action on this mine, Hobet Mine, which was, I think, the biggest. Mountaintop removal sounds very sterile. You're really blowing off the tops of the mountains and all the to get to the coal seams underneath. And then what you blow off, they would just dump in the valleys and cover up the streams. So it was bad on every level, and it created a tremendous amount of air pollution, and it was polluting the, you know, the water supply, and it was a mess. It was really horrible. It's still going on, but you know, there's the demand for coal has dropped precipitously since the first time I went there. Every means of, except airplanes, every means of transport was used to move the coal. I mean, we were on these highways, and these full coal trucks would go by every few minutes. We'd see these long lines of rail cars, you know, with, you know, trains pulling cars, you know, 100 cars, I don't know, full of coal. And then there would be barges on the rivers. So it was pretty amazing how quickly they were taking this stuff out. But it's dropped a lot since then, but there still is, that practice is still going on. And one time, we were in a pretty uncomfortable situation with miners who didn't want to lose their jobs. And the miners' wives, I have to say, were really in our faces, actually, more than the miners themselves. So yeah, it was somewhat uncomfortable. But I also, you know, went to the Capitol, the West Virginia State Capitol, when they were talking about legislation and when they were talking about impacts of, you know, some of the stuff that was happening. Also, I have a friend, a roommate, a housemate from when I lived in Boston in the early 70s, who was in medical school at the time, and then went down to work at a health clinic in West Virginia his whole career. He lived and worked there for like 40 years, and he just retired. And so I got to talk to him about health impacts, especially black lung, which is just a horrible, you know, it just suffocates you. And there's been a resurgence of it after it got better, somewhat better. Now it's gotten worse again, and with younger minors. So that's a pretty horrible thing. And I did a whole feature about that once too, in the, you know, like the mid-teens or something.
Wow, that's quite an adventure. I commend you. You know, I don't like to travel too much, but you have been globetrotting and traveling a lot. You've been down to the southern border.
Yeah, I was. That's right. That was in 2019, just this time of year. Well, it was late March and early April. So almost five, I can't believe it, almost 5 years ago.
Wow. We are speaking with Melinda Tuhus, independent journalist, but also a WPKN programmer and journalist who has contributed her research and interviews and really incomparable material here at the station for, it turns out, way longer than I even knew. And so it's fantastic to chat with you, Melinda. And I'm so glad that you're still doing the show. And I do hope that, you know, you'll get more exposure and more attention will be paid to this program, as well as all the other of the talk, public affairs, and interview shows on our roster, which number somewhere around 42, believe it or not. Well, more than, I think, NPR. So
I'm glad you're doing this. I don't, you know, particularly, I much prefer being on the other side of the interview, but I think it's good to do this and really highlight, as you said, 42 public affairs and interview shows on WPKN. And, you know, if this runs and garners me any more listeners, that would be pretty awesome. So thank you for doing it, Richard.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a fun time for me to do an interview with a professional interviewer. So. Well, thank you so much, Melinda Tuhus, whose show will air this coming Saturday at 9:30 a.m., 9:30 until 10 a.m., just before, I should say, the Resistance Roundtable, which will also air this coming Saturday. My pleasure to have you, and keep up the fantastic work.
Thank you, Richard. It was fun talking with you.
Great.